I took a poll of the SDAs in March, and at that point there were 600 people on waiting lists around the state. It's entirely possible that some of those individuals could be exhausting their benefits as they wait to get into a training program.
So we want to get this wagon rolling. We can do this bill. There's still some opportunity to negotiate about extra bucks we can negotiate, but at least this way we can get this to the floor and be doing good things and get people back on board. Thank you. I'm getting nods from you guys.
Mr. Chair, I want a little bit more clarification. I'm caught between what the Senate had in there and making it retroactive to January or putting an emergency clause. If we put the Senate language in, we'd be able to pick up people who had been who had ran out of funds last month. Okay. And if we don't, and we just put an emergency clause on, that would mean the people would currently have to be drawing unemployment on whatever day we the bill was passed. Is that right?
Representative Domini, those individuals, if they're an exhaustee and they still have a valid benefit year, then we could pick them up. The people that we would have difficulty with would be somebody whose benefit year has expired prior to the enactment date of the legislation.
But the Senate amendment, the Senate portion that was taken out, mm-hmm. would have even picked those people back as far as January. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I don't have a copy of the A. Engrossed bill to look at.
She read your amendment. Here it is. Come from always.
Now I have more of them.
Representative Domini, in response to your question, Representative Domini, I think we would still interpret the Senate language to mean that they still had to have a be within a valid benefit year. If the benefit year had expired, I don't think we could pick them up under that language.
So it doesn't make any difference which language you use it in. It may end up with the same result. Is that correct?
I think there's a misunderstanding here, if I may, Mr. Chair. The emergency clause is to capture people who today, right now, are expiring and you want to help them right away instead of waiting 3 months. The retroactivity clause is to not only help the people who are expiring right now or very soon, but to go back and pull back into the lifeboat the people who are out there thrashing around with no assistance. And the retroactivity clause is helpful for those people, but they just have to have been within their benefit year, even within their retroactivity time. Is that right?
Yes, you're correct, Representative Mannix. As an illustration, if the person came in on January 1 and filed their UI claim and collected benefits continuously, then their 26 weeks is going to expire just about the time that the biennium begins here. And that was the concern, was not to cut those people out just because they didn't quite meet the beginning of the effective date of the act. So if you adopt the Senate language, then we would be able to go back and to pick up those people who should be exhausting just about the time that this would come into play. The emergency clause would then help in that we would be able to help them immediately beginning July 1 instead of having to wait for 3 months. But it would connect up if you adopted both.
Are we ready for a work session?
We are in a work session.
Oh, good. Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I move the A3 amendments.
She says one.
No, we're in another
work. Okay, we're going to go into a work session.
Now, Mr. Chairman? No. I move the A3 amendments.
Okay. Any objections to the A3 amendments?
If I want to make a suggestion as to change the amendments, you want me to wait until they're adopted?
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's no objection to accept the amendments?
I'd like to go back real quick to something I touched on earlier. Recognizing that no matter how much money we put in, there's going to be a limited amount of money for the whole state. And then getting back to this issue of dislocated timber workers versus other kinds of workers, can you use my concern that I see this pool of funds being just kind of, I mean, each JTPA outfit around the state is going to kind of say, hey, I want my share, and grab for his share. And then after he or she has got his share for his program, then he's going to try and find people that maybe can arguably fit into this dislocated worker program definition, so that we end up with funds being dissipated out into areas of the state where there really isn't truly a hard-hit, structurally disrupted industry that's laying off a lot of people.
Representative Johnson, I think the private industry councils and the local operators are very accountable in terms of the kinds of individuals that they enroll in programs. In your area, for example, in talking with Norm Bichon, I know that they are enrolling predominantly dislocated timber workers.
It's easy in my view, that's all there is.
Right, and I think that, you know, the dislocated worker program is in fact driven by the need in a given area. I mean, it is not a program where we can say we're going to serve 50 of those and 20 of those. You're driven to a large extent by the economic circumstance around you. This is not, what we're talking about here is not, for example, a pool of money that people can just grab and get their share and run with. These benefits are going to be used in support of individuals who are in training programs, who have gotten there by virtue of their appropriateness for the training program and their apparent ability to complete that and really benefit from it. So I don't see a frivolous grab at money being any kind of possibility here.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I have to, because it keyed something when Representative Johnson asked the question. It keyed a question that was asked of me a couple of weeks ago by an individual who lives in Roseburg. And he said that he did not work for a sawmill. He worked for a saw filing shop. And because the sawmills are down, the saw filing shop is down. And his concern was, if we're not careful in our definition, the JIP programs are going to have trouble defining whether these people are in or out of the dislocated timber workers. And do you see this definition that's in here about what is a structurally unemployed causing you some problems in the area that I just spoke about, you know? And then there's, you got the guy that does the laundry for the Shaw shop. I mean, where does it end? That's the question.
Representative Adami, the issue of secondary and tertiary dislocation is one that we're very, very aware of. It's given us fits. Some of the proposed definitions that might be used have troubled us considerably, because you take a small town, Cascade Locks, for example, where the mill went down, there were only 70-some people, but that was two-thirds of the town, essentially. And what didn't go down in the sawmill went down in the service industries and secondary industries around it. So short answer is, I think this definition will allow us to serve those people. It will not hinder our service to those people.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Whoops, he left.
Go ahead.
I was just going to make an amendment, but I want to do that after. Do we want?
What kind of amendment do you want
to
make?
I wanted to move to amend Section 3 of the A engrossed back into the bill. That's the provision that...
retroactivity.
The retroactivity. I wanted to do both of them. I don't think I want to do them both in the same motion, but...
All right.
This would be on page 2 of the Hannon Gross bill, section 3. Not Hannon Gross, the A and Gross. Page 2, section 3, reading, notwithstanding any other provision of law, comma, any individual who met the qualifications of, and then it be modified of this act on or after January 1, 1990, is eligible for benefits prescribed in this act. Yeah. And we'll have it conform to meet the appropriate section.
That was the motion.
That's your motion?
Yes.
Okay. No objection. Is there any objections to the motion? You understand what the motion does? Okay. Okay, if there's no objections, we're accepting it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would also move to add an emergency clause to the bill.
Okay. Any objections to the amendment to add the emergency clause? Okay, hearing none, we'll accept that.
Chair?
Yes.
Are we going to do the
as amended?
Are we going to do that 50% thing?
No.
No, we don't need.
Okay. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, I move to rescind any referral to Ways and Means, first of all.
Okay. I guess Mr. Campbell's not here. He can't object.
He can do that later.
I'll have an okay. Is there any objections to sending that? I don't know if I have the authority to.
Well, we can do it. The okay. Speaker wants to intervene. That will be his business.
Okay.
Thank you, Jim. Nobody.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I move. Well, we had the emergency clause already put in, so I move the bill as amended to the floor to pass.
Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Dominic.
Aye.
Representative Edmonds.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Mannix.
Aye.
Representative Repine.
Aye.
Representative
what?
Aye.
Representative
Durfler. Aye. Thank you. I repeat, I think this is probably one of the most important things we've done
hallelujah.
In this committee.
Thank you, gentlemen.
And I think it gives us a real opportunity to address a really serious problem. And Representative Johnson would like to carry the bill. Okay.
Well, we need
to. Let's take a 5-minute break.
Thank you.
Almost what?
Nothing.
I need
break. You need a break. What do we got?
House Bill 3584.
We have House Bill 3584. A hearing on it. Chris Davey, you want to come up?
What are we doing, Ross?
We're hearing House Bill 3584.
Mr. Davey. Gentlemen, House Bill 3584 was on the calendar earlier. However, we didn't get to it that day. What this bill is, and you have not had a hearing on it yet, is the bill in its form as it was originally drafted would provide that any party that has properly requested a request for reconsideration relating to workers' compensation, but who had not received a final order within 15 days, may request a hearing on the matter. The 3584-1 amendments were proposed by the Workers' Comp Department, and they define what a properly completed request is.
Okay. Chris, thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Chris Davey, and I represent Safe Corporation, and I'm here to speak in opposition to House Bill 3584.
In both versions, Chris?
Both versions, yes.
Okay.
The versions are somewhat different, and the opposition is based on different points in different versions, but certainly with this bill, the potential for returning to the process of determining extent of disability through litigation rather than through the administrative process of reconsideration is great, more so in the original version than in the amended version. And in both versions, again, there is a number of statutory references to reconsideration that were included when 1197 was passed that are overlooked in this bill and leave a lot of unanswered questions about how they would be interpreted. Just by way of a little background, the reconsideration process that was created in 1197 is intended to be an impartial administrative forum to review notices of closure or just determination orders that have been issued by the evaluation division. And the process includes a truly independent medical review by a medical arbiter or a panel that is selected by the evaluation section. Well, I guess it's the appellate unit now in the Department of Insurance and Finance. The problem that...
What do you mean truly independent?
Well, truly independent in the sense that the person is hired by the department as an independent person rather than hired by the
worker. As opposed to the independent medical examinations that are not truly independent.
Right. The problem that developed in the department is that they created a fairly cumbersome procedure for dealing with these reconsiderations. And with a lack of experience and a lack of personnel to administer it properly, there was a backlog that developed, and that caused consternation for a number of parties. But they've taken control of that situation. They've revised their procedures. They've hired a new manager, and the results there look good. They've reduced that backlog considerably, and I understand that it's now taking less than 60 days to issue these orders. It's still not to the point where it should be, but they have a plan to get there, and it looks like they will. So the question really is, why is this bill needed in the first place if the problem is being remedied? And secondly, is this an appropriate remedy? It would seem that the purpose of this is to motivate the department to issue their orders timely, but there really is nothing in the bill or the amendments that actually serves as a motivation to the department, because they don't suffer in any way through not issuing the orders timely. In fact, the party who suffers will be the opposing party to the one who requested reconsideration, because they don't get the benefit of the administrative review and they have to go through a litigation process. If that party is the employer or insurer, they will also lose the opportunity to stay payment of any permanent partial disability that was awarded, because under 1197, you can only stay payment on appeal from an order on reconsideration. If there is no order on reconsideration, then you can't stay payment. In addition to those quarrels with the concept of the bill, you have before you a list of a number of things that I think have been overlooked when the bill was drafted, and I won't go through all of those. I will pick out the significant ones, though. The first one is that in 656, 283, and 295, and those are the statutes that deal with hearings and review by the board, it states that the disability will be evaluated as of the date of the issuance of a reconsideration order. Now, in this situation, we're saying that there will be no reconsideration order, and it will go straight to a referee to decide the case. The referee will not know what standard or what date to use as the basis for determining the disability.
We assume that it would go back to the date of the close, when the close is made on the case.
Mr. Chairman, you're assuming it would go back to the date of the original closure?
Is that correct, Kevin? You heard what he was saying.
Yes, I did. Say, well, actually, go back I've got a solution to a lot of these problems that I'm going to propose.
Okay. Well, I'm only testifying on what I've seen, which is the original bill and the amendments, and there are problems with both of those, and that's just one of the problems. And it could be specified what date would be used, but it's not specified in these versions.
Chairman?
Yes.
I think the bill should specify what the date should specify. You'll hear some proposals to specify that if there is no order on reconsideration, it shall be processed as though there was an order denying reconsideration on the last day that reconsideration could have been allowed, that all further proceedings will proceed as though there had been an order denying reconsideration. That will answer part of the question. I think there's also an issue that's still in discussion here about the whole time frame here, whether or not we wanted to have two hearings processes, because, and I've worked with DIF on their proposed amendments, but I have to say, and they'll hear this right now, that I'm having second thoughts. Do we either want to speed up this process and make it clean and quick, or dirty and quick, depending on your point of view, or do we want to expand the administrative review as it's happening into a true reevaluation of the whole closure, or is this an opportunity to correct an error? I don't want to drag it on, but what I'm getting at is the issue that has arisen has people on both sides complaining, and yes, there are the problems being addressed. The bottom line still is, how detailed is this review reconsideration process supposed to be? Is it supposed to be focused on correcting errors, or is it a substitute for a hearing which we provide for later? We can agree that we want to lock in the evidentiary record, lock in the date of reconsideration as far as what's going to be looked at, and have a very precise time frame. You either do it
or it's deemed denied, wouldn't that clean up a lot of things?
Yes, Representative Mannix, I think most parties would agree that the ideal would be not to have a complete hearing process through reconsideration. I mean, the concept of reconsideration, I think, is that you have another group of people that take a quick look at what the first group did and decide whether it was right or not, and then you still have the issue of the medical arbiters and panels, which necessarily takes time.
And what if we specify that if there's an order referring it for medical arbitration or allowing medical arbiter review, if that is issued within the 15 days, then you have the 60 additional days for medical arbiter review. And then if there still hasn't been an order on reconsideration within the 75 days,
mandates.
Bang, it's over. Medical arbiter could say, well, my report is in the word processor, and you say, well, we're sorry. It's as though the order on reconsideration has been denied. There's been an order denying reconsideration. And in other words, make it very clear, very clean, and very precise. But I agree with you, we need to address the medical arbiter issue, too. That way, though, everybody knows this is the game plan, and we're going to be able to move with these deadlines, and if the deadline is not met, it's though reconsideration was denied. Just throwing that out for your comments, since I didn't want to surprise you later on.
Representative Mannix, I think that that would certainly be a lot better solution than in either of the versions that I've seen up to this point. Just picking up on a couple more points here that are unclear, the standard of review that would be used by a referee if there is no reconsideration order issued is unclear. 2837 only talks about the standard when reviewing a reconsideration order, and doesn't specify what standard would be used if there is no order.
Can I ask a quick question on that?
Sure.
But if we say that review shall be just as though there had been an order denying reconsideration, then the referee should act as though the order simply said, we've reviewed it and we deny reconsideration, a very perfunctory order perhaps, but locks in the evidence. It also locks in the date. Would that do the trick?
Yes, Representative Mannix, that would clarify that. Also, there is the whole issue of the response to a reconsideration order. The statute doesn't provide a process of response or require the department to send notice right now. The practice has been that, and I just looked at this last week, that when they get a reconsideration request from one party, they send a letter to the other party and allow 3 weeks for that party to respond. That's not provided in statute, and I think if we're dealing with tight time frames here, it would need to be clear that there is some provision for that.
Can I inquire again?
Mm-hmm.
What if we just assume there isn't going to be a request for a response? The moving party had better get in there and provide some information that causes some change of tune. Just require that they review that and decide whether they want to reconsider and just go from there, because anyone could still request a hearing on that.
Well, Representative Mannix, shouldn't the opposing party have an opportunity to review any new information that's provided by the requesting party?
Well, that's, I guess this gets to the nub of the issue here, because that's what a hearings process might be for, is full adjudication and everyone going through responses and arguments and counterarguments. But just as a claim closure right now is done in-house by an insurer or an employer, or is done in-house by evaluation section, we don't really have an opportunity for response at that point. Shouldn't the order on reconsideration just be an administrative process where if the administrator sees some additional information and wants to do something with it, they can. But if not, then we get right over into the hearings form. I'm just throwing out that question.
Well, Representative Mannix, I think there may be circumstances in which some new, different material that is quite different than what is in the record that already exists has been presented, then the other party should have an opportunity to see that and respond to it.
But shouldn't the other party have already submitted all that material in the request for a DO, or have considered that? I guess you're saying some additional medical that developed after the closure but before the reconsideration.
Yes.
Should we put in a provision that specifically allows, if that happens, for us to freeze the process while the other party has a chance to respond, instead of delaying all of these reconsiderations?
That would help.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Another point, deals with the admissibility of subsequent medical evidence if no reconsideration order is issued. Again, this is a point in the statute that says that after reconsideration there will be no subsequent medical evidence admitted. Again, if there is no reconsideration, what do you do? 319 also talks about the time allowed to request a hearing after reconsideration, and this was not mentioned in either version. And then finally, in the amendments, it says that the 15 days starts to run after the receipt of the items labeled A, B, and C. And I think it needs to be clear that it's not just one of those three that necessarily starts the 15 days. It depends on which ones have actually are appropriate in that situation. So that completes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Well, you have us thoroughly confused anyway. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Am I hearing you with your testimony that somehow or another this may cause you to deny more claims if we were to pass this? I wonder if that's possible, but I mean, would it maybe cause you to deny more claims?
Deny any more claims.
Representative Dumney, this doesn't have anything to do with denying claims.
Well, it's because you're going to have to make a decision sooner about whether what you're going to do with a claim. Am I correct?
No. No, Representative Dumney. This deals with reconsideration of permanent disability awards. The normal situation is either the carrier closes the claim or the department closes the claim. And then if either party is unhappy with that closing order, then they can request reconsideration. And then reconsideration is an administrative process within the department, and if either party is unhappy with the result of that, then the parties can request a hearing. The proposal here is that rather than allow the reconsideration process to be completed, if it's not completed within however many days it's decided, then it would allow a request for hearing without the reconsideration being completed. It has nothing to do with denial of benefits. It's simply review of orders that have already been issued.
Okay, any questions for Chris? Thank you for your help. Mr. Moore, Mr. Moore.
More and more.
More and more, huh? Thank you for both coming in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for keeping these proceedings light. My name is Robert C.A. Moore. I represent the Oregon Trial Lawyers and the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys. And on my right is Christopher Moore from Maligon, Moore & Johnson, who is going to testify to you on House Bill 3584.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I guess my testimony changed somewhat this morning when I discovered that the Benzinger versus Workers' Comp Division, Department of Insurance and Finance, had issued at the Court of Appeals. And that case was one in which the Department of Insurance and Finance was sued in circuit court, and an order was obtained from Judge Haas in Portland requiring the department to issue orders on reconsideration within 15 days. That was appealed and was argued before the Court of Appeals approximately a month ago, and the court issued its decision today saying, yes, indeed, they were unwilling to rewrite the statute and that 15 days is 15 days and shall mean shall. So I have a new problem, and that new problem is now that the court has told us that they read the statute the same way that I read the statute, how do I go about enforcing it? And Representative Mannix was discussing with the previous witness a situation where we allow the department 15 days in circumstances where no medical arbiter is requested, and then the request for reconsideration is deemed denied. That would allow either party to request a hearing. Would, I think, solve that problem, at least in the majority of cases out of my office. Representative Mannix and Mr. Davey were also correct. You do have to make some provision for the request for a medical arbiter or the medical arbitration panel and allow 75 days, which is what's in the statute. And I think that would also solve the problem. At this point, I can tell you what I thought the problem was before this morning, and what I thought the problem was is that the department simply was misinterpreting the law. I happen to have the transcript of the testimony at that trial, the Benzinger trial, and what the department testified to at that trial was that the statute provided a guide within which they would issue orders on reconsideration. And so what happened is you would send in a request for reconsideration and you'd get a letter back saying the parties now have an additional 15 days to submit additional evidence. Now, I asked one of my legal assistants to go through every request for reconsideration we had submitted to the department, and as of the May 29th, we were still batting around 10% back. Now, we've gotten a bunch in the last week or so, and we're happy about that. But what was equally disturbing is it was taking the department 15 days to acknowledge our request for reconsideration. And there's a problem up there, and the problem from our perspective is our clients don't have the opportunity to get done with the claim process, to get their final adjudication of what's going to happen to their claim. Now, I don't represent employers or self-insured employers, or pardon me, insurers or self-insured employers, but I can tell you that if I were an employer paying somebody permanent total disability or permanent partial disability that I didn't think they were entitled to, I'd be angry if I were sitting up there, if I had a request for reconsideration sitting at the department for 4 to 6 months and I was paying money that I felt I wasn't obligated to pay and I couldn't request a hearing and I couldn't stop payment of those benefits. As I understand from SB 1197, the reconsideration process is to correct some very simple mistakes. Did the department get it wrong when they said you were 45, in fact you're 39, or vice versa? Did they get it wrong when they said you had a high school education and in fact you didn't have a high school education? Those are very small errors that are easy to correct. That just shouldn't take very long. This is not the place where we want to gather a lot of information and have our knockdown drag them out about what the claim is all about. It's a place to solve some simple problems. There are a couple of other points that I wanted to make.